And our special guest tonight, of course, Paula Harris. And we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Paula, let's talk a little bit about Dr. John Mack, the late Dr. John Mack, whom we tragically lost a few years ago in England when he stepped off a curb and got hit by a drunk driver.
Yeah, he was a wonderful, wonderful person, and I had him as a guest at my home here in Rome for 3 days, and probably one of the most knowledgeable, intelligent, and compassionate human beings. I really, really miss him.
Let's talk about his work and why you included it in your book.
Well, because that was one of his final talks, and it was done in Florence, Italy, to a group of young people. We have a group of very young ufologists here under the age of 30 years old that he loved to speak to young people because they had such an open mind. And basically what he said in that talk, and it's in my book, is that a lot of the abductions or the contact had become direct. Instead of the people being taken bodily now, they were getting direct downloads from the ETs, and that this had changed. This aspect of the contact or the abduction experience had changed recently, where people are getting downloaded directly with messages from ET civilizations. And he talked about the fact that we as a populace on Earth would have to change our attitude. Otherwise, if we take our attitude out into outer space, we could become a, quote, the virus of the universe. And this is a real policy issue. It's one that Paul Hellyer is worried about, too. If we take, if we go in and put a base on the moon and we go to Mars and we take nuclear with us and all our values, quote unquote values with us, I don't know if we're going to be invited to be part of whatever confederation is out there.
What did you think of John Mack, Paula, as an individual?
Well, he was, the one thing that I liked about him is his style. I mean, he was not, he did not have preconceived notions. He didn't have like a box everything had to fit into, which a lot of researchers have, especially the ones that deal with contact. They already know what they want to hear, and they try to put into the box that which they want to hear. He was completely open. He basically just listened. And tried, probably he was connecting the dots in his mind, but he never let you know what they were. And he was, he listened fully to the contactee, because there was one here that he talked to. We have one contactee who does incredible paintings of aliens in the style of Leonardo da Vinci. And he had turned around to me in Florence and said to me, "Why aren't you doing this story?" And I said to him, "Because I don't do contactee stories, John. I do military or intelligence or this kind of story." Little did I know that I would be doing contactee stories 3 years later. So he wanted me to be more open-minded in my reporting also. He was open-minded and basically thought, and he did think that whatever presence was, it was not to be categorized bad or good, good or evil. It was just alien.
Did he ever share with you how he felt about his peers mocking him, because he was a psychiatrist, mocking him for what he did and the way he moved into that field of abductees?
Yeah, he basically had a lot of trouble in the beginning at Harvard. It's in my book because he talks about having a lot of trouble initially because he took on cases that were non-conventional, and they did kind of ban him for a while until some very credible people came into it saying they had been contacted. And when these very credible people came on board, they didn't know what to do with the information. When you have people that have no ulterior motives, that have contact, incredible people, the way he mentions names in the talk, then they changed their minds and said, "Well, you know, go ahead and research this." But remember, it's still research. So he had a hard time. But then John was very good friends with Bud Hopkins, because we went on vacation together, all of us, in at least 3 years ago in Newport. So he was very good friends with Jacobs and Hopkins and people that didn't necessarily have the same point of view. And I think that's marvelous. this, because that shows a study. It shows that people can get along that don't, you know, necessarily agree. And the UFO community is not like that, George. I mean, there's a lot of infighting, as you know.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. What changed John Mack's mind? Obviously, he was a psychiatrist. He was a professor at Harvard. What changed his mind, Paula? He wasn't in this field all the time.
He had too many cases like this. And then he did another thing that was totally amazing that our Italian psychologists aren't doing. He traveled. He went to Africa for that case of the school children that the UFO landed in the schoolyard. He flew to Africa. He flew to Tepoztlán.
On his own expenses, too, right?
Pardon?
His own expense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, at his own expense. And he flew to Tepoztlán in Mexico to talk to Carlos Diaz. And he flew to all the places where there was contact that had some kind of substance. And that's the thing I do. I mean, this is what's so hard for me, is because I fly or go physically to the places to talk to the sources. I don't do either internet work or telephone work. I have to look. You asked me what made Maurizio Cavallo credible. I had to visit him 3 times and stay in a hotel for 3 days before I was even convinced to do that story. It's like, you know, he did the field research, and I think he got many, many cases saying the same kind of thing. And if you're intelligent researcher that's saying the same kind of thing, you need to look at the reality of it.
Are you convinced that what he came across, the people he had as patients, that this was all real?
Oh, I think that you get all kinds. I think you get all kinds. I think that that probably a good number of them were real. But then after, when you get to be famous and people want you to regress them, I mean, it's just part of the deal, you know? You can get all kinds of people. And the contact scenario for me is very difficult. It's been the most challenging of all the part of ufology. In fact, you know, researchers of the olden days or the old type, old guard, won't even go there. They consider contact the lunatic fringe, which is not true. But I did too. I can honestly tell you that in the beginning, I wouldn't touch contact. But I think that happens with somebody like John, that, you know, everybody wants to be regressed. And a lot of people, maybe some of their experiences are not as good as others. So that's just an opinion. But I think that John was a great researcher. I mean, I watched him in action here in Italy, and he was able to place together a lot of already, already capsulized information he had from other cases. And the fact that he traveled and did a number of cases all over the world really, really shows that he was a great researcher.
Did he confide in you what he believed, what he thought was going on?
Well, I think we had a conversation about the human race in general. The human race as part in other words, the human race is not an isolated race. We could possibly be involved with, either ET seeding or AT relationships from way back when. I don't think the human race necessarily is not involved with celestial cultures. So we were talking about that at the very end, and he was looking at the dimensional part of this. He was studying life after death. Okay, John was working with Mark Cummings on a book on life after death, which is very, very ironic, because he made a comment as he was working on the life after death scenario that it was easier to work from the other side. So the thing is that he put it all together as a dimensional situation, as a life after death, as a, you know, the fact that we live in alternate realities. I think that John reached that point. He was talking about those kinds of things to me. So, you know, I wanted it. He was connecting the dots, because this isn't just about abductions. This isn't just about contact. This is about what we believe our reality is. And that there is no death, that there is just another dimension, that these people could be coming from other dimensions, that there is no time. It's more complicated than we believe. My book talks about time travel and this kind of thing, too.
It is complicated. You know, what years ago, if you believed in the abduction theories, you thought it was just a, you know, here it is, it's black and white. Extraterrestrials are visiting us. They're abducting people, testing people for who knows what. It could be much broader than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be, because I do believe that there probably are some that are, you know, are staged. There are probably some that have screen memories, attached to it. It's not a clear picture. That's one of the reasons I don't really, you know, I'm not really good at that part of the research. Even though I will report word for word what the contactee Mauricio Coelho says, what the Charles Hall story says, that's not really contactee. He saw those beings, as Mauricio did. I'll try to report the best I can on what people tell me so that intelligent humanoids can put together the picture. I'm sure the more you know, the more confusing it gets, George.
Absolutely. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, good friend of the program, Apollo 14 astronaut. He believes that this planet has been visited in the past, coming from an astronaut who's been on the moon. I find that to be fascinating, Paula, and dramatic. And you?
Well, he's a good friend, and he's very broad-minded, considering that he himself has not seen a UFO in space but has talked to his colleagues.
That's so true.
And not only that, he did go to the Pentagon to ask about the Roswell case that everybody's still calling balsa wood and aluminum. I can't believe that. And he said that did happen, and he was told that. It's in my book. He then tries to place together this on that multidimensional level because, you know, Edgar Mitchell is interested in ESP. He's interested. He's a friend of Uri Geller's. He helped fund the SRI experiments with Hal Putoff and Russell Targ. They really did happen.
Heads up the Noetic Institute, right?
Right. He instituted the Noetic Sciences. And he did something really, really amazing, George. I mean, he was doing ESP experiments from the moon. Probably unbeknownst to NASA, that were successful. So what does that tell you about the human mind, meditation, sending messages mentally? It was from the moon. I think it changed his life when he looked at there was a whole other side to the human being. We don't just need the work of Ingo Swann, who talks about it in Penetration. That, by the way, people should read that book, because that does have an encounter with a human-like alien in a supermarket in California.
Yeah, that's an incredible story.
Yet you heard about that story?
Yeah, sure. I've got it in my book, Worker in the Light. Ingo was a dear friend of my late aunt, Paula, who was a psychiatrist in her own right, who went on to study the paranormal. She was very interested in the power of the psychic world. And she and Ingo were just dear friends. And he writes a lot about, in that book, Penetration, how he believes it was an extraterrestrial that he saw at a supermarket.
Right? A supermarket, yeah, picking fruit. I mean,
yeah.
And that he went close to her, and then he was accosted by two people in suits saying, don't go near her.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at her. Well, what does that tell you? Does that tell you something, that somebody knows who the ETs are and they're watching them? Evidently, she's not doing anything abnormal. She's just shopping. And this is kind of and I'm glad you talked about this, because the story of Maurizio Cavallo doesn't seem so incredible when he's saying that these people are here in Italy and they live here and they are among regular people. So we have examples of that, you know, with Ingo's work, and I trust Ingo and I trust his testimony, because he's a very, very, very special person. And so I'm trying to put this all together in my mind, as you probably are in yours, that it's not unusual for extraterrestrials who look like us to be walking amongst us.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, when Edgar Cayce was on this program several years ago, and I asked him directly, did you see anything when you went to the moon? And he answered very, you know, directly and politely, no, I didn't see anything unusual. Then I asked him, of course, you know, did you see any UFOs while you were on your way to the moon? He said, no, I did not. And then the final question was, well, in that case, Edgar, what do you believe? And he says, I believe we've been visited here on this planet from beings from another planet, and this is why. And he went on to explain, as you have illustrated, that people that he believes have told him that this is the absolute case. And again, if he believes it from friends that he believes are higher ups, that's an incredible story.
Well, he's doing the same thing you are and I'm doing and the people that are really studying this are doing. We're trying to put it together. And so he has a lot of contacts where he can speak to people about their experiences. And it's connected with the paranormal. People don't want to go to the paranormal, but it's connected to what we call, that's not the paranormal at all, it's normal. It's connected to that. So Edgar is very interested in the ESP part. He is a friend of Uri Geller's. For me, Uri Geller is the key to a lot.
We may have Uri on the program sometime next week, by the way.
I'd love to listen to that.
Keep our fingers crossed. Yeah, he's been on before. And Uri got, you know, all this happened to him when he was a little boy. He didn't like to talk about it a lot, as you know.
Well,
but he got zapped by
the UFO part.
Right. He got zapped by a UFO, didn't he?
He got zapped by a light being, and I heard, because Uri is a friend, that the person he was in a park, he was 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old, and there was another person that witnessed this, and that he found this witness after many years, and evidently that light that zapped him between the eyes followed him home, and this is the ball of light phenomenon that I'm talking about. These balls of light that appear in not only on the island of Sicily in Caronia, but this ball of light that zapped Uri, and who knows if it's a real ball or if it's a manifestation of a being or an entity or an intelligence. He found corroborating evidence to that this year. I mean, he's talked in Israel. He's been on TV a lot in Israel about this experience, but he won't go to the UFO part because he, you know, our society has the UFO as being lunatics, you know, ridicule, not something serious. And Uri, of course, is not going to go there because he has a lot of other interests that are, you know, don't want to touch that.
And as a matter of fact, he was talking to us live from Israel when they were getting bombed by Hezbollah.
Right.
And he was talking about how a small missile landed right by him. And we had him on the phone while he was there. And lost him once, got him back on the air. He's been a champion. I mean, I've seen him perform live. I don't think it's magic.
I think he
has a gift.
No, I know him. He's done some things in my presence that have totally been unusual.
Well, he has started watches from coast to coast listeners who have had watches that have never started or that have died. He said, hold them up by your radio. And I'm getting hundreds of fast blasts at the time from people. And I'll tell you, the funniest part about Uri Geller is we played the show back another day. I took one of my rare vacation days. And we played that show as one of our best ofs. And darn if it didn't still work, because I came back the following Monday and I'm looking at all these old messages from people who are saying, Uri Geller started my watch up again. And that was off of a tape of Uri Geller. So he's got the power.
So what does that tell us? What does that Uri isn't, if there is such thing as someone who has altered, Uri is one of them, and this is a conclusion I came to after knowing Uri and after studying Uri's involvement in the 70s with Spielberg, having met Spielberg, having met Jacques Vallée, Close Encounters coming out, Edgar Mitchell's involvement with Uri. I think that Uri and the person that's most like Uri in that I met was Michael Wolff, Dr. Michael Wolff, but because they were both the same kind of person. Uri Geller is very different. He won't talk about it except if you talk up to him in private. He will say there is a responsibility to tell the people of Earth about this reality, and he's doing the best he can under the circumstances. But Uri, the powers he has, you got to understand that if he's there on the border of Lebanon, he's not there as a soldier. That ESP is valued. The fact that he can do these things is very valued. The fact that he can perceive, the fact that he has these, he says that everybody has them, and I truly believe, so does Ingo Swann, that we all have ESP, we all have a sixth sense. It's just that something happened to Uri when he was 3 or 4 years old that really heightened this sense.
Very good. And Paula, when I was talking about Edgar Mitchell, did I say Edgar Casey at all?
No, you did. I was
okay. I thought, because people are saying, when did you have him on the show? Casey died in 45. I don't think I had him on. I meant Edgar Mitchell, of course. I'll be back. Well, more to come with Paula Harris. Next hour, though, we will open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with her. She is an expert. Her book is called Exopolitics: How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light? Paula, we've had Al Bielek on the program, the Philadelphia Experiment. He is getting up in age. Tell me your interest in him.
Well, I've been interested in time travel ever since Colonel Corso talked to me about the fact that they had worked in time travel technology. And by accident, you know, everything happens by coincidence with me. I saw him at the International UFO Congress in Laughlin. I stopped him and did an interview with him because I wanted to know about the Philadelphia Experiment, something that Colonel Corso said really did happen. And so he, you know, talked to me about the Philadelphia Experiment and about his involvement with it, which is an absolutely amazing story. I tried to digest the story because it deals also with the transport of consciousness from one person to another. But I tried to take some elements of what he told me, like the fact that when you do these kinds of experiments, you open up a rift in time that lets in not only alien ships, but different alien populations. And I took some of the things that he said that fit with other things that I had heard. So, you know, it was very interesting to me, that information. It was really interesting. It's really hard to verify anything like this, but I think it should be told. And so I found him, you know, to be very interesting. Al Bielek's story, I think, needs to be read. And I think the Philadelphia Experiment, I am sure it happened. And the Tesla technology at that time, he said Tesla backed out of it, that Einstein took over. Well, you know, that's an absolute possibility. And this whole thing about time travel is a big mystery. And I think that his testimony is something that should be read.
He is a remarkable man. We're going to try to get him back on the program again. We're also trying to help him out because he's had a whole group of bad luck lately, Paula.
Yeah, he's physically had some physical problems. I admire the man, and I'm so honored to have him in my book. And I have talked to him, and he has a website, and he's still, you know, plugging away there because he says this is real. A lot of people believe, George, that this whole UFO question is centered around time travel.
Yes, that's true. Some people do, and they believe they are us.
Like the Dan Burrish story, and I have an interview with Dan Burrish in my book, too, because I went to visit him three times also and tried to digest what he was telling me, which I think, you know, is very possible. So, you know, he is very sincere. He has the background. He has documentation. And the idea that a J-Rod would be us from the future is not, you know, is not science fiction. I think that there's a reality that we're not looking at, that we can't face, that we don't know about.
Well, I got to tell you, he's just a remarkable individual. And I hope he fights back from his fight of hard luck.
Well, I hope you have him on because he has an incredible story to tell.
Yeah, well, he's been on before. We've had him on. I had him on about a year or so ago, but it's always worth getting him on because, you know, even though he's been around for a long time, the information changes a little bit. It gets even more exciting, believe it or not.
It does. It does, and I'll tell you, I had to include him because this is all part of the UFO connecting the dots picture.
Tell me a little bit of Yvonne Smith and her role with all of this.
Well, Yvonne Smith's been around for a long time. She is a psychotherapist who lives in Los Angeles and is very good friends with David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins and in the old days with John. And she is one of those psychotherapist that has a tremendous amount of compassion and is going forward with this work because, you know, a lot of these contactees don't have anywhere to go. They have things happen to them that they can't go to the conventional sources.
And they get ridiculed.
Absolutely. Well,
that's an understatement.
Yes.
That is an understatement.
Well, that's an understatement. I mean, if you go to someone and say, yes, I was taken by an alien, you know, and these things happened to me, our society does not accept this, okay? It is what I said before, the contact scenario is the lunatic fringe. And I've actually heard researchers, the old guard researchers, actually say this. They're still way back in the scientific study of the skies, what's in the skies, or taking soil samples, or what, haven't gone past that. And Yvonne Smith is really active now. She will be at Roswell. You know, there is the 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash. She will be monitoring a panel there with Don Schmidt. Mm-hmm. With probably Stanton will be there. A lot of people will be there. Jesse Marcel's new book will be there, will be debuting there. And I will be there, too, but I'll be there covering all this.
Let's take some time to talk about Dr. Stephen Greer, Paul, and then, of course, we're going to open up the phone lines next hour. Here's an individual who seems to work just incredibly long hours to try to get disclosure. I mean, he has done everything I think an individual can do, devoting his time, resources, energy to getting the word out, putting together a group of incredible people during his disclosure project, and still can't get the recognition that he seeks. Why?
Well, there, first of all, can I preface this by saying that the two of the steamrollers in my book, the people that give 150,000% energy to this, are Richard Hoagland, and I have to say this, because I've been with Richard Hoagland and Robin at their home, and I know what Richard does, and Stephen Greer. Stephen Greer is a steamroller, too. When you have that kind of energy, when you have that kind of commitment, when you have that kind of responsibility, and Stephen feels it, so does Richard, that you just, it appears to people that you already have the answers and that you're aggressive in some way or whatever. For me, Stephen Greer is the only person that was able to put together enough witness testimony. He didn't use ufologists or researchers. He used military intelligence people that were involved firsthand with this. And the reason why I don't think it worked is because it was done in the United States. It was done in a place where the media does not cover even the brand new Lima, Peru sighting that was, I don't know if you've heard about this, because the film footage is on YouTube. It's the last couple of days.
Right.
Well,
right.
Why isn't it on CNN? I mean, it's all over the world. We've got it here in Italy. Why aren't you getting it on CNN? The Lima, Peru footage is almost like the flotilla footage.
Well, because generally the mainstream media generally doesn't take these cases seriously. They don't. You know, even the incredible stories of the Phoenix Lights and issues like that. They really, you know, they don't take it seriously yet.
Which to me is the single most important incident that happened in the last year, because you can't control a UFO sitting over an airport. I mean, that wasn't covered until a month later. The reason why Stephen is having trouble is because of the media. And in the interview in my book, he said it's the death of the Fourth Estate, because the Fourth Estate was that the media was supposed to be a controller or a balancer of the other powers of the government. In other words, you know, the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the media was supposed to make sure that everybody did their job. Well, if the media it belongs to transnational companies, and it's not doing its job, and it didn't do it with the Lima sighting, obviously, then where do you go? Stephen is like looking at a brick wall, and that's the reason. And then Stephen is a steamroller. His personality is very powerful, and you know, researchers in the field, researchers should be kinder to other researchers, and they should work together more, because Stephen is a gift to all of the researchers in the field. I find his work extraordinary. But to answer your question, it's about the media.
You had mentioned Dan Burrish. I had his mother on not too long ago, Dodie, and she hasn't seen him, heard from him in years. You might want to get the two of them together, Paula.
Well, I think that family issues are real tricky, and I think that probably there's some issues there, and And I think that if Dan wanted to get together with her, he probably would have. And I'm glad that you're looking at all of it, which is what a journalist should do, George.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as soon as we get involved in the minutiae of all this, we've got a problem.
Right. You got to look at all of it, what everybody, you put it all out there. And I believe people are intelligent. They can figure it out. I think that one of the things that I'm trying to do is just report they called me the Barbara Walters of ufology.
Oh, you are. You and Linda Moulton Howe remind me so much of each other because you just don't stop. I mean, if there's a story out there, you two go crazy until you get it.
Yeah, and it's just to give it to you and everybody else. I mean, it's not because, I mean, there was something written about fame, fortune, money in ufology. I have spent more money of my own money doing everything. I have, my whole life has been dedicated to this disclosure situation. And like you, George, I'm hoping it'll happen in my lifetime, and that's where all this power comes from, or all this energy comes from.
I got after Stephen a few months ago when he said that a couple internal people from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, had told him that they definitely had signals from extraterrestrials from another system. And then I had Seth Shostak on, who represents SETI, and he said, no, if we did, we'd let the world know. But Stephen would never reveal who they were, never reveal the sources. And then I got after him a little bit. And keep in mind, I think he does great work. He's been chasing this zero-point energy for a long time. And he just, you know, he keeps talking about an individual who's going to bring him the machinery to prove that it exists or that it can be done. And it hasn't happened yet. And I think through all of this, one of Stephen's shortcomings is that he believes too many people, Paula.
I do think the SETI thing, and we've had SETI as a guest here at San Marino, the SETI group, mm-hmm. with Drake and so forth. If your job depends on this, and you have disclosure, your job is finished.
I don't think it's over. I think it's enhanced.
I do believe that Close Encounters is real. I've done a lot of background search, and if you remember Close Encounters...
There's not a lot of people who work at SETI, so if Stephen has two of them, it could be like two of four. I mean, there's just not a lot of people there yet.
We have Italian SETI. We have an Italian...
Yeah, but he was talking about U.S. here.
Oh, U.S. Well, the thing is, if they did receive signals, I don't think you'd know about it. I really believe I don't think you'd know about it because of what I said before. I don't know if the world is ready for this kind of situation. Plus, if you had signals, how would you decipher them? I mean, what would you... Close Encounters had the music signals. Do you remember that?
Yeah, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, right.
Da.
Well, somebody told Spielberg something. To have that be in that film.
Maybe so. You know, I've been wanting to interview Stephen for years. I'd still like to get him on the program to ask him, because I do believe he'll be very truthful, what he knows, what he's been told. If some of these movies, the E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and all the others that he has since gone on to produce, if it was based on inside knowledge and information, I'd love to find that out.
Well, I have a quote in my book, and I have the film footage to prove it, because I do it in my conferences, where Stephen is talking to young people. Again, it's kids. Young people at the actor's studio, and a girl just comes out and asks him, do you believe in aliens? And he goes through this long thing about having been told to listen by his parents a long time ago. At the very end, he says, yes, I do believe in aliens.
Yeah, well, Ronald Reagan believed also. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I mean, when you say the word believe, it's kind of hard because believe, I always put it as a connotation with some kind of religion or belief system. I'd rather use do you know that aliens exist than believe, because believe makes it sound like a religious thing.
I agree. Anyways, what is Stephen Greer's frustration level? I mean, how long does he keep at this before he feels as if he's either knocking his head against a brick wall or that he's going to bust loose and something's going to finally get disclosed?
Well, there's a lot. going on with Stephen? If you read his new book, he's a contactee. I mean, he was his whole life is strange. I mean, it's not an accident that he's put all of his energy into this. When he was very young, he was, and then he was prepared too, because he spent some time in Israel. He's very spiritual. He learned meditation, and he had contact himself, you know, mental contact, and also filmed, you know, light beings. Here we go with light again, in his CSETI protocols. His CSETI protocols are the only protocols that we have established for a peaceful connection with whatever's out there. In other words, his CSETI protocols are respectful. They what they do is they get the people together, they go on a mountain, they meditate, and if there is anything up there, they telepathically say, with respect, if you are, you know, benevolent or whatever, with respect, we want to greet you. And those protocols are the only ones in action. Now, you had mentioned the zero energy machine. That's a lot of stuff that Stephen's taking on, and that might be the only thing I would say. Stay with one thing like disclosure and the CSETI protocols, which will really help us. But the reason why he's into the energy machine is because, as Al Gore and as Paul Hellyer say, these technologies that are hidden from us could save planet Earth. So Stephen goes there mentally, and that's what he says. If we get these technologies, we could save the ecological disaster of the planet. And so he's put everything into the cosmic minestrone.
You were going to tell us a little bit more about this case in Sicily. Do you have a few minutes for that one?
Yeah, because that's why my book is entitled How Do You Speak to a Ball of Light?
Go ahead.
Because, the case in Sicily is 140 people in this small town in Sicily near the water called Caronia. And what was happening there were that these balls of light were coming out of the water, and they were going into the homes, and some of them were visible to the people, and they were interacting with the electricity where the houses would self-combust. So on television, we would get all these news about self-combusting houses going on fire for no reason. So the electric company went down there and did the only thing they could do, which is shut off the electricity. And what would happen is the phenomenon continued. But even more, they had photographs of UFOs, unidentified flying objects in the air. And then the phenomenon continued, and so the people got very upset. Now, remember, the balls of light would be coming out of the water around the people. They would visibly see them around the animals, you know, the pets, and they would see them, and the washing machine would catch on fire. So it was around machines and around electrical wires, even when the electricity was turned off. The only thing they could do after 2.5 years, because the military police were there, the police were there, were move the 140 people out of Caronia and set up the whole entire village with cameras, surveillance cameras.
Oh, my. They were serious.
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't know what to do. I mean, this is one of the problems with the UFO phenomenon, because I talked to somebody involved in the investigation, and he said, we don't know what to do. We know these balls of light are coming out of the water. These huge orbs are coming out of the water. We know they're interacting with the house. Of course, it's stopped now. The people are gone from the homes. But they're very upset because the people want to go back into their homes, and they're wanting the Italian government to give them damages. You know, the damage.
Yeah.
But you've got balls of light coming out of the water that are not hostile because they haven't burned or killed anybody. You've got balls of light there, George. And then you have the orbs of the fast walkers that are seen in space by NASA during STS-75 when the tether was broken, where you see that film footage of these pulsating balls of light. So I think we should be studying that. I've gone one step further to look at the light phenomenon, and of course, the people in Sicily have said that telepathically they had some kind of communication with this.
All right, Paula, stick with us because we've got you for one more hour, and now we open up the phone line. So get ready to go. Paula Harris, our guest, along with you, as we talk about her book, Exopolitics, How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light? I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM.